You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 2016 Western Christadelphian Bible School at Manuka. This is the second class in a series given by Brother Jeff Pagy on the subject, Second Principles of the Bible Guiding Us on the Way. This class is titled, Seek Justice.
Well, good morning, folks. So the subjects of the next two classes really have to do with justice. And being brought up a Christadelphian and being around Christadelphia for my, as we highlighted yesterday, or I think 45 years, I haven't heard too many talks on this subject. So maybe you have, maybe you've read it. I know there's some people that are more well-read than I am in this room. Maybe you've done a lot of reading on this. This is a subject that, as I started really highlighting a few of my favorite verses, I came across this word and really got me thinking. And I have to tell you, after we go through these next two classes, I'm not going to claim I have all the answers. There's still some things on this subject that I'm still struggling with. And hopefully you'll see some of my conundrums, and we'll get into those as well. But as we get into this, I think you see justice in everywhere we live. The two pictures I have up here, one is probably near and dear to some of the people here in Portland. Supposedly it's on, I think it's I-5, I'm not sure. And you have the drawbridge going up, and you have that one car trying to get in. Oh, that just gets my blood going, right? You know, it's this white car here, maybe this car way up there trying to get in. Where's justice in that, you know? The next picture is, if you've ever been to Hawaii, it's a one-lane road, the road to Hana. Very narrow. You come across two cars. Who gives? We actually have a road very similar to that in Three Rivers where we live. The river's rushing on one side, and you have a big cliff on the other. Who gives? One with fewer lug nuts. That's possibly the case. You know, you come up to it, you have the same number of lug nuts on the car. Well, it's usually the car that's closer to the pullout would be the one that would back out, right? You know, how does justice kind of play through that? Well, how about if you're pulling a trailer? Who goes first? You know, maybe the car without that. How about if two cars with two trailers come? Boy, you're having some trouble there, you know? So justice, rules, jabs come up into it. They're in our lives. I mean, this is another touchy subject here. Gun rights versus gun control. I'm not going to even touch that. But, you know, you get into it. I live in a rural community. You can tell people what their gun rights. How about gun control, keeping people safe? Those types of things. How does justice and righteousness play into these type of things? I love this one. The state of California, most people here in this Bible school are from the state of California. I work in insurance. The insurance laws in California will make you pull your hair out. An interesting guy back in the 80s got a proposition on the ballot that tells us how we're supposed to rate for auto insurance. The most important thing in auto insurance in California is the number of miles driven, according to this guy. This guy also wrote into the law a full-time, high-paying job for himself. It's very interesting how that played through. But the state of California, the most, you know, you have to report your mileage. And as an insurance company, most people in the state of California, according to people that report to us, only drive 7,000 miles a year. How does justice and righteousness come into that? You could talk about reporting on your taxes. By the way, actually, the numbers of miles you drive is not as important as other variables in the rating algorithms. I can go into details for hours on that. I'll be doing that next week in Montana, but I'll keep you saved from that. But there's many other things to predict if you're going to have a car accident or not. How does justice play into that? So, cup of coffee. I know we all like our cup of coffees here. $3 a day if we go to Starbucks or Coffee Bean or probably one of these other places or cafes here. We can easily pay $3 a day, $15 a week. That could be anywhere from $750 to $1,500 a year that we're probably paying for a coffee in our morning get-go. But when the bag gets passed around, are we putting our fair share into that? So, interesting aside, we were talking about some of the generational shifts. I am the treasurer of our ecclesia. I'm not going to get into who's all donating what, but I noticed a trend. And, you know, I noticed that my grandparents' generation, all their donations went to the ecclesia, and the ecclesia figure out how they wanted to spend the donations. I noticed my parents' generation, it's almost 50-50. I know some of their donations come through the ecclesia. Some I know there are hidden causes on their own. When I get to my generation, it's more hit and miss. When I get to that 20s and 30-something, I see fewer and fewer donations coming through. Now the 20 and 30-somethings here may think that. So I start thinking, well, why is that? And 20 and 30-somethings say, you know, I know all the elderly in the meeting, they'll take care of the finances of the ecclesia, but where's the justice and equality that go into that? So just a little aside, if you're in those 20-somethings or 30-somethings, or you get in that mindset of how you're given, at least think of what your fair share is. Look at the ecclesial financial report, divide it up by the numbers, and say, how much does it take to keep the lights on and keep the air conditioning going and keeping the things that we need to do as ecclesia? Maybe that is only $10 or $15 a week. Maybe use that as a starting point for your donations as well. We'll talk a little later with the presentation we have on Agape in Action. $30 a month goes to help some of those that are less fortunate as well. But we could talk about justice and equality and how does that all play through in that. And the more I go through life, the more I realize that I fight for the status quo in my own life. You know, a lot of these talks are probably for me as well. You know, change? Ugh. But I've learned through my life as well that change happens so quickly in our life. Basically, about a month ago, I had a boss who left a very high-paying job at another company. His salary is public information. He could go out there. It's mid triple digits or six-digit income. A lot of money. Came to our company looking for something else to move up in the organization. He was coaching me a couple weeks ago saying, you know, just keep going, be very active. I'm not worried about being fired. You shouldn't be worried about being fired. Next week I get a call from his boss. Hey, we asked him to move on, and you're going to have a new boss coming on board. Change happens in the world around us. What we fight for, what we try to keep in status quo, I think is there. So as we're going through this subject, there's two verses that really, you know, again, are some of my favorite verses. And I've been spending a lot of time on this word here. And we'll talk a little bit about some of these other words and other phrases coming up. But Micah 6, verse 8 is one of my favorite verses. He has shown you, O mortal, what is good. What does the Lord require of you? To act justly. And to love mercy and to walk humbly with your God. And we'll speak a little bit more at our last class on the love mercy and walk humbly. But to act justly. And I've really been spending a lot of time thinking about that. And a year ago we started Isaiah in our Sunday school. And we came across Isaiah 1 verse 16 through 17. And this verse really kind of got me too. And it's like, you know, wash yourself, make yourself clean. Remove the evil of your deeds from my sight. Cease to do evil. Learn to do good. Seek justice. Seek justice. Reprove the ruthless. Defend the orphan. Plead for the widow. So these verses, I mean, this really started really getting my mind thinking. You have one as the previous verse, to act justly, and this one to seek justice. And I was like, really? I mean, God is telling me that I need to be seeking justice in the things that I'm doing. The way I interact and the way I look towards my family, the way I look to the brotherhood, the way I look to fellow mankind, I'm supposed to be seeking justice in these things that I'm doing in life. And I tell you, as I go through this, I still don't have all the answers. I don't know at what spectrum does that justice go. And we'll talk a little bit more. I see some examples in the world around us that bring me to tears when I read the things that they're saying. But we'll talk at least from the personal experiences what this means, and we'll get into it. And as we get into it as well, you go through many different types of verses here, and you come across, when you do this study, pretty quickly. I mean, it's a part of God's character. It's ingrained in how God shows himself to us and how he's representing himself to us. In Deuteronomy chapter 10, you get a view of God's character, and you have the echoes of these verses brought up continually. And in Deuteronomy chapter 10, starting, I think, verse 11 or verse 12, it says, "Now, Israel, what does the Lord your God require from you but to fear the Lord your God, to walk in all his ways," there you go, in ways from our class yesterday, "and to love him, to serve the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul, and to keep the Lord's commandments and his statutes, which I am commanding you today for you, for your good. Behold, the Lord your God belong heaven and the highest heaven and the earth and all that is in it. Yet on your fathers did the Lord set his affection to love them, and he chose their descendants after them, even above all people, as it is this day. So circumcise your heart and stiffen your neck no longer. For the Lord your God is the God of gods and the Lord of lords, and great and the mighty, the awesome God, who does not show partiality nor take a bribe. He executes justice for the orphan and for the widow, and he shows his love for the alien by giving food and clothing. So show your love for the alien. For you who are aliens in the land of Egypt, you shall fear the Lord your God. You shall serve him and cling to him. You shall swear by his name. He is your praise, and he is your God, who has done these great and awesome things for you, which your eyes have seen." After reading that, I probably need to just sit down. But I go through those verses, and I get really put in my place pretty quickly. We had a Take Back the Night festival at our local town, where we had some local amateur astronomers come out and really zoom in on some of these. Well, I just look up at the heaven and see as a star. You know, they zoom in on their telescopes and they zoom in. It's really not just two stars, but it's really two galaxies. And in those two galaxies, they keep zooming in, and there's millions and millions of stars at each one of those galaxies there. Boy, do I feel small. When I feel prideful, I just think about those pictures. He is God of the highest heavens. So who are we to be asking questions of him? He's master of this earth. God's character, he executes justice. He's looking out for the orphan and the widows. He's looking out for the less fortunate. And the next one really kind of hit me, especially with a lot of the politics that are going on right now. He's looking out for the aliens in the land. Those people that are without a home coming into an area. And you can listen to many different types of talks on this, and I have. There's this one TED talk out there that really, really strikes me right now. We know the stuff that's going on in Syria right now. And this girl from a middle-class family fled Syria and went to Egypt. A middle-class family. Hey, most of us in here, I'll consider middle-class. They got kicked out of Syria. They got it going into Egypt. She fell in love with a guy. And it was all on the up and up. And they had some family in Europe. And they wanted to smuggle her to get her into Europe with her fiancé. She was on a boat of 500 people. The boat was set off to sea. They get about halfway across the Mediterranean. The smugglers tell her to get on with the other 500 people onto this other boat. That this boat already had 500 people. It was jam-packed. They try to get on a smaller boat that was probably only really carry about 50 people, and they try to get all 500 on there. They refused. The smugglers, in the end, basically try to sink this boat with 500 people, and they are good at it. The boat sinks. People are just grabbing anything that floats. This girl, young 20s, can't even swim. But she was given something to float on. Another mother with a toddler could hardly hold the toddler up anymore, gave the toddler to this one girl to hold on to. So she's taking care of this other girl. A couple days later, still out there in sea, an infant. A mom's trying to hold up this infant and is losing strength and basically gives the infant over to the girl to hold on to. Out of about 500 people, I don't do the story justice, out of about 500 people, only about, I think, 15 or 20 survive. These are what people are dealing with on a day-to-day-out basis. But God says we need to take care of the alien. Now, I tell you, from a political standpoint, I probably lean more conservative. But I look at this type of thing and go, boy, we need to take care of the aliens, and are we doing that? So I say I'm struggling with this justice piece, guys. At what stage does it go? Where does it go? So, you know, it is in God's character. And the next couple of examples, I really want to look at how God did selected a few people. So we know the promises to Abraham. And the promises of Abraham, you see brought up in this, and basically God says, "For I have chosen him so that he may command his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing righteousness and justice, so the Lord may bring upon Abraham what he has spoken about him." So Abraham was picked because he was righteous and he practiced justice. And I really, through my mind, was trying to go through that. It's like, well, where do I see examples of Abraham acting righteous and justice and putting that into his lives? And you may come up with examples on this. The best example where I could see where Abraham was looking out for the welfare of the less fortunate was associated with these numbers. Anybody know what these numbers mean? Yeah, these are the numbers that Abraham was asking the angels in order to save the city. And you can just see it in Abraham's character as he goes through it. He starts with the 50. There's just 50 righteous people. Yes, hopefully Lot went into that town and started preaching, and maybe he got 50 believers to come with him. I want to plead for those 50 out of the thousands that were in that city. Abraham kept thinking, well, maybe it's 45. Maybe it's only 45. And he goes back a second time and pleads for the 45. You see the example of justice coming through, Abraham was pleading for the 40, and he pleads for 30, and he pleads for 20. And at the end, he's just pleading for 10. Lot and his household and a handful of believers. I know he went down with hundreds of people in his household. Maybe just 10 are still righteous. Will you not destroy the town for 10? So I see example there. You see Abraham looking out for the justice and righteousness for those that are in the town. We all know David. And I look at David and I look at, there's probably many examples of how he was a just and righteous king. And I look at this story, and this is a story when he was dealing with the Amalekites. David was really fleeing Saul at the time, and he went with the Philistines, and he did this, I think, kind of a nifty thing, and tried to tell the Philistines, "Hey, you know, give me this area down here in this hot, deserty area, and I'll clean this area out of the riffraff." Well, the Philistines thought the riffraff was the Jews. In his mind, the riffraff was the Gentiles and Amalekites. He was going out there and doing these raids, and he gets back from one of these raids. And if you know the story in 1 Samuel 30, then it happened when David and his men came to Ziklag on the third day. Now, I know it's very temperate temperature out here. It's probably in the nice 70s or 80s. If you've ever been to this part of Israel, it is hot. Very hot. And if you ever worked out in very hot weather, it takes a lot out of you. And you've been traveling for 3 days. Just coming back from a raid that took a lot of physical activity. It was hot. You were tired. And then as a man, I could look at all the husbands in this room here. If you had your wife and your kids taken from you, that would just hit you in the stomach. You would really want to get them back ASAP. You'd do anything in your power to go and get them back. And you can see these men, after traveling and being exhausted for 3 days, they come into their encampment, and their children and their wives and all their goods are gone. You go down to verse 9. So David went, he and 600 men who were with him, and came to the brook Pisor, where those who left behind remained, but David pursued. He and 400 men and the 200 were too exhausted to cross the brook Besor and remained behind with the rest of the goods. So these guys, I mean, they're traveling for 3 days. They see this kid, the kids and their wives are gone. They go traveling for another couple days to go after these Amalekites that have their wives and their kids. You can just imagine the heat and the oppressive heat and the exhaustion that they're going to. And they finally come up to the Amalekites in verse 17. So David slaughtered them. They come up to him in the twilight of the evening. And they slaughtered them from the twilight until the evening of the next day. Boy, it's more than it's at least 24 hours of just physical activity of going out and getting every single one of these guys, these Amalekites that have taken their children and their wives and working and killing them and getting their stuff back. So David recovered all that the Amalekites had taken and rescued his two wives. So a little aside here. I've had times in my life where I've worked many, many hours, probably not to the extent that they've done here. You put in those 50, 60, 70 hour weeks, 8, 10 weeks in a row, 12 weeks in a row, and you finally get that nice big bonus. Isn't that nice? Now, what's your mindset on that? My mindset very easily said the one letter word that we all love, I. I've earned this. I made this. I did this. You know, you worked hard. I mean, these guys worked hard as well. You know, they worked their tails off and exhausted. I mean, these conditions that they were probably in were just probably, you know, stuff that I probably would have lasted, like, consider myself fairly physical, probably would have lasted probably the morning. Come into verse 21 here. When David came to the 200 men who were too exhausted to follow David, who had also been left of the brook Besor, they went out to meet David and to meet the people who were with him. Then David approached the people and greeted them. Then all the wicked men and worthless men among those who went with David said, "Because they did not go with us, we will not give them any of the spoil that we have recovered, except that every man and his wife and his children, that they may lead them away and depart." I just love this phrase here, what David responds to. You know, here's where justice and righteousness come through in this example here. Then David said, "You must not do so, my brothers, with what the Lord has given us." So I don't care how long you work, how hard you work, or what you've done in your lives, what I've done in my lives. At the end of the day, it's what the Lord has been able to allow you to do and has given you. Who has kept us and delivered us into the hand, this band that came against us, and who will listen to you on this matter. For as his share is who goes down to the battle, so shall his share be who stays by the baggage. They shall all share alike. I think that is an amazing thing. You know, the fruits that we get in this life are not ours. It's what God has given us, and it is our duty, as people, to share as much as we can what we've been given. So the next example here is Nehemiah. Now, Nehemiah's time, Nehemiah was asked to leave his high-paying job in the court of the king to go, and he wanted to rebuild the walls. And when you get into Jerusalem, you had some people that had the haves and the have-nots. And, you know, look at the time. I'm going to watch myself here, but you have the haves and the have-nots. And the people that had money, did fairly well when there was a famine in the land. You go through the have-nots in Nehemiah chapter 5. They were basically mortgaging their houses, their fields, letting their kids go be servants in the haves' households and slaves in those households just to put food on the table. Just to put food. Now, I know many of us use debt in many different ways to, you know, do things in life, to build houses, do transportation, many different things. I pray that many of us are not using debt to put food on the table. But that was the situation in Nehemiah. They were using, you go through that, they're using, going into debt with their fellow brothers and sisters to put food on the table. I hope that's not happening in our brotherhood at all, but they're doing that. And you can see Nehemiah's response in Nehemiah chapter 5. He comes up to him and it says, he was very angry when I heard the outcry. He hopped down in verse 9. What you're doing is not good. He called the priests, which I think were part of the haves, and said, you guys need to be example here. You cannot be going out and put in and having your fellow brothers and sisters owing you money just to put food on the table. You should be the ones feeding them. You should be the ones taking care of them. Look at what God has told us. He defends the weak, the orphans, the widows. And you're just going against what God has done that. He has blessed you with the riches and wealth. And what are you doing? So I think that's, again, another great example, biblical example. You've seen how Nehemiah is looking to help out others around him. So let's get into these words. Righteousness and judgment. You see these words many times in the Old Testament tied with each other. And I'm not a Hebrew scholar, but if you look at the Hebrew words, righteousness, and that might be called judgment in the King James Bible, is tishdek. And judgment, which is the word I'm going to be concentrating a lot more on, is the mishpat. It's that. So mishpat is one person defined it, is an even-handed or retributive justice, that is justice by the book, where tzedak is a situational distributive justice, that is justice that is tailored to a response to a particular circumstance or particular situation, especially those that lead to social or economical or political injustice. My notes will be available later if you want to look at this a little more closely. If you go through the Bible, these two words are tied together 60 times. I find that very interesting. You see both the situational type judgment playing through and the judgment by the book playing through as well. And I just have two verses there. There's 58 more verses there that tie it in. Righteousness and justice are the foundation of his throne, God's throne, in Proverbs. You have righteousness and justice are the foundation of his throne, power and dominion of a righteous God. So you see these two tied hand in hand. So the next question I have for the group, the word judgment here, mishpat, is also translated ordinances and justice. What book of the Bible, and there's actually one chapter in the Bible, has the most occurrences of this word? Any guesses here? Oh, bad, you looked at my notes. Thank you, Randy. I want to pick at that. So I asked the younger folks, they're going, hey, I think it's be Deuteronomy, it might be Leviticus, it might be Exodus. Psalm 119 has this. It's probably cheating because that's probably the biggest book of the Bible, right? But 23 times. So if you really want to study and really learn and really think about God's justice, read Psalms 119, and 23 times it's there. And if we had a little bit more time, I'd ask us to read through some of those verses, because I think there's a lot in those verses that you could get into and read. And again, it's a great study to get into it. So in our society, I think self-help is one of the biggest things that I see and probably grabs my eye on the internet. I'm always looking for ways to improve myself, right? So you look at Yahoo, what's the 5 ways that you can have more financial security? What are the 8 ways to have a better healthy you? What are the 6 ways you could do better exercises? There's all these self-help books. You go to a bookstore, you go on Amazon, these things are around us. But when we look at justice, I think what we need to be thinking about is selfless help. How can we look to help somebody else that's not for our own benefit? The selfless help as it comes through on it. And I think there's ways that God has encouraged us to do this. So here's a selfless help. Okay, so here's a way to help you be more selfless in how you think. And if you're studying the word of judgment, Mishpat, you easily come to this one verse in Exodus chapter 28. And it's a whole area of Exodus chapter 28. And this whole verse and this whole chapter is called the breastplate of judgment. I never really kind of put those two together. I always knew it was the breastplate the high priest wore, but it's the breastplate of judgment. And if you go through it, and let's just read through it really quickly here. A lot of verses here. You just see the intricacy here. You see the specificness here. You see where it was supposed to be worn. You see when it was supposed to be worn. I think there's a lot to be said about it. And you shall make a breastplate of judgment, the work of skillful workmen, like the work of the ephod. You shall make it of gold, of blue and purple, scarlet material and fine twisted linen. You shall make it. It shall be square and folded, double, a span in length and a span in width. It shall mount on it four rows of stones. The first row shall be the row of ruby, topaz, emerald, and the second row as turquoise, sapphire, a diamond, and the third row of sacinth and agate and amethyst. The fourth row of beryl and onyx and jasper. They shall be set on gold filigree. The graving of the stone shall be according to the names of the sons of Israel, 12, according to their names. They shall be like the graving of a seal. You shall make the breastplate two rings of gold, and you shall put two rings of gold at the end of the breastplate. You shall put the two other ends of the gold on the two on the filigree settings, and put them on the shoulder piece of the edge of it, which is toward the inner side of the ephod. You shall make two rings of gold and put them on the bottom of the two shoulder pieces of the ephod, and the front of it shall be the place that it where it is joined. Above the skillfully woven band of the ephod, they shall bind the breastplate by its rings to the rings of the ephod with a blue cord, so that it shall be skillfully woven band of the ephod. And the breastplate will not come loose from the ephod. Aaron shall carry the names of the sons of Israel and the breastpiece of judgment over his heart when he enters the holy place for memorial before the Lord continually. So a lot there and a lot of detail. One artist's rendition of that puts it at that. It's just a very, very beautiful. A lot of detail, a lot of pieces to it. So why do I call it the self-helpless help? Selfless help. I think this was a way for when the high priest was in before the Lord to really have a physical reminder of each tribe of Israel. Each gem represents a different characteristic. If you really get into the gem studies, which I will not do. And benefits of the saints. We have the phrase of cunning work. So it was skillfully devised. It was crafted with careful deliberation. It was not just haphazardly thrown together. It was worn at all times before the Lord, so he had constant concern. And was over the heart for constant care. So you see these examples coming through quite a bit with the breastplate. So I know we do a lot of prayer and meditation, and we think about others. And I use the breastplate as an example for me to think about my ecclesia. Now, I look at us in this room here, and I think we are pretty much have fallen into our routines. We know who's pretty much sitting where we're sitting right now, right? And we're only 2 days into our Bible school. And I'd fathom to say, generally at our ecclesia halls, we generally know who's going to sit in what seat. Even though we don't have assigned seating generally, we know who's going to sit in assigned seating. And I've used that as a way to pray for my fellow brothers and sisters. I just start going through the front row. Start thinking of Sister Y, Sister X. What are they dealing with in their lives? Is there something that I could do to help their lives be a little bit better? You start getting into the middle section. A lot of times it's our young families. Is there things that they're struggling with that I need to pray about? You get into the back. Sometimes you have the young people that are in the back there. It's a way to think about, is there something that I could do in my life to give guidance and direction to their life? God, please use me as a tool there. So the breastplate of judgment is a very good example, I think, you know, for the high priest at the time to go in. Has a lot of similarities. What we need to do, we need to have something constant in our lives to help us, remind us, and get through our lives and our prayers on things. So maybe that's helpful, maybe not. And if I ever have insomnia at night and I can't sleep, I start going through that. I pray to God for forgiveness at the beginning. If I fall asleep before I either start from the back and work forward or the forward work back, that if I fall asleep, that's fine. But at least I'm thinking about my fellow brothers and sisters in the world around me. Maybe it's ecclesias up and down the coast of California, Oregon, and Washington. Maybe it's ecclesias in the world that you maybe have visited in the past. You know, have, I think, if you want a self-helpless help, think of how you could be helping others in those types of things, especially if you've traveled a bit and seen other places in the world. So a lot of times I'm looking to put your knowledge into action, and you know, it's really a challenge I put forward to all you. And we'll explore a little bit more of justice tomorrow, because there's a bit more on this that we could get into. But how we as individuals enact the mishpat and is an even-handed or retributive justice, that is justice by the book in our lives. How do we enact personal justice in our interactions with ourselves, our direct family, and our ecclesia? How do we look to do that? And again, I look at it from God's perspective. When he talks about justice, he's looking for not my right, not what I need from this ecclesia, not what I get from this society around me, but it's looking for the less fortunate, those that need an extra helping hand. We have those radars out to be helping others. If you look at the word tzedek, which is a lot of times translated righteousness, it's developing and creating a system for fair distribution of goods and services and opportunities. How are we doing that as brothers and sisters? How are we doing that as individuals? Are there things that we could be doing differently along those lines? So I commented each time, we're going to close our time with each other with a little prayer meditation. And again, this is not something that I'm going to be doing the prayer, but hopefully guiding your thoughts through the next few minutes. So if you would close your eyes, as we've been encouraged to do, come into a quiet place. We think about God's character. How awe-inspiring he is, how great he is. Now, humbly, we want to come before him, realizing as we're walking with him the things that we do in this life have been enabled by him. It's not our own strength that does it. We've been thinking and talking about justice. And how God puts justice and describes justice as taking care of those that are less fortunate. Like you to have an individual or a cause or a group in mind. Have empathy of where they're at in their lives or that situation at this stage. If you already know what you can do in that situation, I'd ask God for courage to do the right thing. And if you don't know, ask for guidance. Envision what that step or that situation would look like. See it play it out in your mind's eye. see what that final solution would look like. And look forward to that day when that would happen. So as you wrap up your thoughts and your prayers with our Heavenly Father, close it with an amen.